You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. On Thursday, April 11th, 2013, Elizabeth Veron presented the sixth and final lecture in our series entitled The Civil War Through Different Lenses. Ms. Veron's presentation begins with the interesting story of how many women, disguised as men, served in both the Northern and Southern armies during the American Civil War and their fate if caught. Veron then moved on to the remarkable story of Elizabeth Van Loo, a Southerner who became the postmaster at Richmond, Virginia, and a Union spy. Elizabeth Veron is the Langhorne M. Williams Professor in American History at the University of Virginia. She received her master's degree from Swarthmore College and her Ph.D. from Yale. She has held key positions at Wesley College and Temple University, and is a specialist in the Civil War era of the 19th century American South. Ms. Veron is the author of We Mean to Be Counted, White Women and Politics in Antebellum Virginia, and Southern Lady, Yankee Spy, The True Story of Elizabeth Van Loo, a Union Agent in the Heart of the Confederacy. She has won the Lillian Smith Book Award of the Southern Regional Council, the People's Choice Award from the Library of Virginia, and the Richard Slayton Award from the Virginia Historical Society. Her newest book is Disunion, The Coming of the American Civil War, 1789 to 1859. The lecture series was organized by award-winning historian and Charlottesville-based author, lecturer, and cartographer Rick Britton in conjunction with the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Our podcast is entitled Women and War, The Strange Career of Union Spy Elizabeth Van Loo. Here's Elizabeth Veron.
Thank you. It's delightful to be here, and I thank you all for coming out. So the Civil War sesquicentennial is upon us, this 150th anniversary of the war, and it's an occasion for scholars to reflect upon the state of the field of Civil War studies. And one might be tempted to ask, there are a lot of books written on the Civil War, some 60,000 estimated books published on the war. Intimidating, yeah. Is there anything new left to say? And I'd like to propose that there is quite a bit new left to say, and I'll try to illustrate this by highlighting two sort of themes in recent scholarship on the war, and then by introducing you to this fascinating woman, Elizabeth Van Loo of Richmond. So recent scholarship on the war has brought to light the contributions of women to the war effort of the Union and of the Confederacy. So that's my first theme. And a second theme, political divisions within the South and how they contributed to the demise of the Confederacy. Are we doing okay on volume? All right. So I'll say a few words about each of these themes, and then I'm going to tell you about Van Loo, who really embodies them both. But first, let me say a little bit by way of background about women and the Civil War. So for a long time, the standard story that was told both in scholarship and in pop culture about women in the Civil War was a story of women's unflagging devotion to the cause, be it the Union cause or the Confederate cause. And we have in this period, in the eve of the Civil War, a sort of definitions of patriotism that were, as we might put it today, gendered. That is, male civic duty, male patriotism in wartime was synonymous with the exercise of courage on the battlefield. Men were supposed to be brave. Courage, it was thought at the outset of the war, would be decisive. The side that showed the most courage would win. Women's civic duty was synonymous with something else, with sacrifice and benevolence. Sacrifice connoted women's willingness and indeed eagerness to send their men off to war. They were supposed to literally urge men on to battle. And benevolence was the 19th century word for charity. So women were supposed to use their domestic skills and translate them into service for the troops, to roll bandages, to make food, to sew uniforms, and so on. Channel their domestic skills into helping the troops. And this patriotic division of labor, whereby men exercise courage and women embody sacrifice and benevolence, this reflected the predominant gender ideals, definitions of manhood and womanhood in the Victorian era. This was a time in the mid-19th century when women's and men's roles were thought of as sort of as two separate spheres. It was thought that women who were naturally more pious and pure and submissive were were suited for private life or domestic life, the domestic sphere as people imagined and described it then, and men more aggressive and competitive and ambitious were suited for the public sphere. So there was a notion that there was this division of labor between men and women, and that we would see as we went from peacetime to wartime a seamless transition from the pre-war ideals into these wartime ideals of patriotism. And the vast majority of writing on women in the Civil War through the 1960s essentially told us about how women fulfilled their duties as they were spelled out by this ideal of sacrifice and benevolence. And in some sense, the great icon, pop culture icon of this female self-sacrifice is the character Melanie Wilkes from Gone with the Wind, you all remember the movie, who just embodies, you know, this willingness to do whatever it takes for the cause, in this case, the Confederate cause. So since the advent of women's history as a field, this is still a relatively new thing in the 1970s, women's history came into its own as something that you could study in college and read books about. And since this field has taken shape, we now see the Civil War as a conflict over gender roles and relations. So what do I mean by that? Scholars have found a lot of provocative examples of women who felt that the prevailing ideal of sacrifice and benevolence asked too much of them. So they resisted the demands of patriotism. And sometimes they did so in quiet ways. They wrote letters begging their men to desert the army to come back and protect the homestead. Or they wrote letters to the government asking for exemptions for their menfolk from the draft. Both the Union and Confederacy had instituted conscription. We see them protesting in some rather noisy ways. They participated in the big draft riot in New York City in July of 1863, the biggest instance of civil disobedience in American history. They participated in a famous bread riot in Richmond in April of 1863. Working class women feeling that they were languishing in the terrible conditions in Richmond, protesting and then looting the city in search of food and sustenance. So we see evidence, in other words, of discontent and disillusionment, particularly in the South, and it flows from the perception that it was a rich man's war but a poor man's fight, that common people had been made to bear the brunt of the sacrifice. So we see some evidence, in other words, of discontent, of people who say, this demand that I sacrifice my men, this is asking too much, on women registering their discontent. But perhaps even more interestingly, scholars have also found a lot of provocative examples of women who felt that the prevailing ideal asked too little. They wanted to do more than sacrifice their men. They wanted to do more than roll bandages and sew uniforms and so on. And we see, if we look at women's wartime letters and diaries, a very common lament that they would transcribe and indeed sort of confess to their own diaries was, I wish I was a man. Now, we know how deadly this warfare was. The battle casualty rate, chances of being killed or wounded as a Confederate, was 40%, much higher than in any other American war as a percent chance of being killed or wounded. This was a terrible, brutal, bloody business. So why were women saying, I wish I was a man? Well, it was their way of saying they wished that they could give the last full measure of devotion. In a society that valorized courage, a male courage, as the ultimate form of patriotism, they wanted a chance to display courage. So in that spirit, we see countless women move beyond the boundary of woman's sphere and the boundary between home front and battle front and take up roles that are certainly very far removed from their conventional duties. And these women include thousands of female hospital workers. I'll give you just a few examples, and then I'll come around for too long to my female spy, Elizabeth Van Loo. These included thousands of female hospital workers. Some of them were orderlies, some nurses, some hospital managers. There were even a few female physicians during the Civil War. And these female hospital workers encountered some skepticism as they initially volunteered, and some outright hostility from male doctors. This had in part to do with Victorian notions of propriety. It was thought inappropriate for a young woman to be exposed to the bodies of strange men, to be exposed to the gruesome wounds that Civil War battle inflicted. But women would not relent. They pressed for the opportunity to serve as nurses, including as combat nurses, and they eventually won that opportunity. They justified their nursing in part as an extension of their own sort of maternal impulses, and indeed when the Union organized a sort of corps of Army nurses, the head of that corps, Dorothea Dix, said that for her the ideal nurse would be over 30 and plain, meaning not some pretty young thing, but a mother, you know, a mother-like figure whose nursing would be understood as an extension of her maternal impulses. And indeed, some women came to manage hospitals. They were called matrons. And we have some pretty remarkable evidence of how effective they were at that job. A good example is a woman named Sally Tompkins in Richmond. She started a hospital in her own private dwelling that became very, very successful. Her hospital, Tompkins' hospital, tended to 1,333 men over the course of the war, and she lost only 73. Only 73 of them died. And if you know anything about the state of Civil War medicine, that's a pretty remarkable recovery rate. And historians have speculated, it's not the kind of thing we can prove beyond a shadow of a doubt, but there's some evidence that hospitals run by female matrons had a lower mortality rate than those run by men. Why? Because women were paying attention to hygiene and to nutrition and to morale, which were all important parts of healing, nutrition in particular. There were a number of women, Annie Wittenmeyer of Iowa, a good example, who installed special diet kitchens in hospitals so men would be fed diets that would permit them to recover. So we see some evidence, really, of the effectiveness of these female hospital workers. We see women, of course, filling all kinds of jobs that men vacated. Women ran farms and plantations as their men went off to fight. They filled civil service jobs. This was a time, you know, before computers and typewriters, when the business of the government had to be transacted by clerks who were writing things out by hand. And as men left clerkships in places like Washington, D.C., women had to fill their roles. So we see women moving into these bureaucracies and into a new bureaucracy in Richmond, the Confederate capital. These clerkships, high paying and in very high demand. We see women working as factory operatives in arsenals in places like Richmond, handling live ammunition, filling cartridges, helping to provide the armies with literally with their arsenals. These jobs were low-paying and dangerous, and generally filled by working-class women, but they were very much in high demand. Women had to find a way to get by with their men away at the battlefront. We see women moving into teaching. The Civil War accelerates a trend that was already underway before the war, what historians call the feminization of teaching, the association of teaching with women, and the belief that teaching is women's work. And we see this accelerated during the Civil War as women fill the teaching jobs that men have vacated. Most notably, many northern women go south to teach the newly emancipated slaves. There have been laws in places like Virginia that had made it illegal to teach an African American to read or write. One of the first things slaves wanted in freedom was literacy, and women helped to provide that. So we see a wide range of activities by women, and perhaps the most sort of striking, it's at the extreme end of the spectrum of women's wartime contributions, is that historians have discovered and documented about 250 cases of women disguising as men and fighting as soldiers in the Union and Confederate armies. And this is surely a low estimate. I mean, these are people who were discovered. There surely were many more who weren't discovered, and people tended not to be discovered unless they were injured or captured, and their ruse sort of came to light. So who were these women who disguised as men and fought as soldiers in the Union and Confederate ranks? They tended to be of immigrant or frontier or farming or working class background. So these were not sort of, you know, soft-handed plantation ladies. They were hardy souls inured to physical rigors, women who were pretty tough. They had a wide range of motivations. Some sought the good wage that soldiers earned. A soldier's salary was more than a woman could make doing just about anything in this period, any kind of wage work. Most seemed to have followed their menfolk. They disguised as men and went into the army because they wanted to be near husbands, brothers, uncles, and so on. Female soldiers participated in every major battle and campaign. They earned promotions and medals. They were prisoners of war. They were wounded and killed. So how did they escape detection? This kind of remarkable statistic begs that question. Well, we have to remember that both armies contained a fair share of very young men on the edge of adolescence, and women in uniform could appear to belong to this sort of whiskerless crew, if you will. You know, people often referred to Civil War soldiers as the boys, and there's a reason. Some of them were quite young, and women were hoping, in a sense, to be mistaken for these young fellows. I'll sometimes say to my students, too, we have to remember, it seems to us impossible that one could maintain this ruse, as some of these soldiers did over the course of the entire war. But this was a time, we have to remember, when to see a woman in pants was virtually unthinkable. So if you saw someone wearing pants, you assumed it was a man. It was out of your experience to see a woman wearing pants. And you know, they got caught in a variety of ways. There are some anecdotes. One woman got caught when some apples were falling from a tree, and she lifted up her shirt as you would lift a skirt to catch the apples. And one of her fellow soldiers said, "That looks a little suspicious," and found her out. So there were all sorts of complications. So what happened if these women were caught? Well, their fate rested on what sorts of motivations they professed. So a woman who justified having dressed as a soldier and was caught, if she said, "Look, all I wanted to do was stay near my men folk," she might be let off easy, perhaps just discharged and sent home. But a woman who seems to have enlisted for money or glory or fame, things that were supposed to be the exclusive prerogatives of men, she might find herself punished more severely, perhaps even clapped into prison. Some women were such good soldiers they were allowed to remain in the ranks in disguise, in kind of an open secret. And surprisingly, this was truer for southern distaff soldiers than for northern ones. And this is a little surprising on the face of it. It's understood by historians that the South was the more patriarchal society than the North, if you will, women's roles more constrained there. But of course, the South was also the side more desperate for manpower, and some of these women were allowed to remain in the ranks. So this brings me briefly to a second theme before I bring old Van Leeuw onto the stage. It's commonplace for us to equate the Confederacy and the South. We'll say the South lost the Civil War. I do it, everybody does it. But a number of recent studies have shown that shorthand glosses over crucial divisions within the South and obscures the strong presence of Southern Unionists who opposed the Confederacy and who wanted the Union to win the war. The South was divided by a number of regional fault lines, and one of them we can see from the higher vantage points here in Seville, the Appalachian Mountain Range. Southern counties that straddled the mountains in western Virginia, North Carolina, eastern Kentucky and Tennessee, northern Georgia and Mississippi, they had their own distinct economies of small-scale yeoman farming. Farmers there may have had more in common with farmers in Ohio and Pennsylvania than with great plantation owners in South Carolina. So we see pockets of white Southern Unionists in these sorts of places. There was also a fault line dividing the border South or upper South, states like Virginia, from the deep South. And upper South states tended to have closer cultural and economic ties to the North and stronger cohorts of Unionists than deep South states did. And you know, a way to encapsulate this in a number is Virginia has a famous secession vote in April of 1861, in which the state votes to secede. The final tally in that vote, 88-55. So the secessionists win, but it's not a sweep. South Carolina, by contrast, it had its vote, had deliberated for all of 3 days, and the vote was 169-0. So they're very different kinds of settings. So we can translate these divisions into another set of striking numbers, thanks to the work of a scholar named William Freeling, the author of a book provocatively titled The South Versus the South. He shows that this blew my mind when I first read this. Nothing I'd read before had prepared me for this statistic, but he's able to show that some 450,000 men from slave states wore the Union blue. 450,000 men from slave states fought for the Union. Now, some of this is not that surprising. 150,000 of them were African Americans who supported the Union for obvious reasons, although it was quite a battle, as I'm sure you know, for them to be permitted to fight. 200,000 were from whites in those four slave states that did not secede, Missouri, Maryland, Kentucky, and Delaware. Again, perhaps not that surprising. But 100,000 of them were whites from Confederate states like Virginia. And the most famous example is perhaps General George Thomas, the famous Union Rock of Chickamauga, a Virginian who decided to stay with the Union rather than side with the Confederacy. So Freeling notes provocatively again that these 450,000 men were half as many men as the entire Confederate army and could replace every slain federal soldier and then some over the course of the war. So these statistics give us a new perspective on an old debate. Did the Confederacy lose because of the overwhelming numbers and resources of the North, as Lee would say at Appomattox, or did the Confederacy die of internal causes, of a failure of its own will? If we look at the presence of these Southern Unionists in the South, we can fuse these two explanations and see that internal divisions in the South contributed to the North's manpower advantage. That is to say, the Confederacy could not and did not command the loyalty of the entire South. The architects of secession were hoping it would, But it didn't. The Confederacy was not able to command the loyalty of all Southerners. And that brings me to my story of Elizabeth Van Loo, because these two themes of women's contributions and of Southern unionism are illustrated by the life of this quite remarkable woman. She, Van Loo, V-A-N-L-E-W, a name of Dutch origins. So Van Loo was the subject of my book entitled Southern Lady Yankee Spy. That encapsulates much of her long and improbable life. She was born in 1818 and died in 1900. Life spans the 19th century. She's an obscure figure to the vast majority of Americans, but to Richmonders of a certain vintage, she's a household name, someone who's had the kind of status as a legend in Richmond. Van Loo was an elite Richmonder, the daughter of Northern parents who had moved to the South and put down roots there and had acquired all the trappings of gentility. Her parents, Northern, but very eager to assimilate fully to Southern slaveholding society. They had acquired slaves and a beautiful mansion on Church Hill, a mansion that was thought to be the most commanding, pleasing view in all of Richmond. Elizabeth was sent north for an education and then came back to Richmond. She harbored misgivings about slavery, and when her father died, she and her mother, Eliza, seemed to have arranged a secret freedom for the family's slaves, who stayed on with the Van Loos as paid servants. There was a law in Virginia at the time that if a slave was freed here, she had to leave the Commonwealth in a year. So to free someone was to exile him or her. And the Van Loos appear to have given a secret freedom to their slaves and paid them wages to stay on. Elizabeth's doubts about slavery blossomed into full-scale abolitionism during the secession crisis, these months in which Virginia is in the wake of Lincoln's election, these months in which Virginia is debating whether or not to throw its lot in with the Confederacy and join the Deep South states that had already seceded. She lived in Richmond where the secession debates took place, and she watched those debates with disbelief and horror because she felt that people like her, unionists, were being intimidated and sort of shunted to the side, marginalized by the secessionists. She believed that secessionists were blinded and indeed really made mad, unstable, hysterical by their fealty, their devotion to slavery, and that the secessionists were betraying Virginia and the South. So here's a key to understanding this phenomenon of Southern unionism. Van Loo believed herself, she believed she was the one who was being true to Virginia and the South by standing with the Union. She had this view, it was not uncommon among Virginians of her elite social milieu. She saw Virginia as the mother of all states, the architect of the Union. She thought that she had a responsibility to her own revolutionary forebears and to the state's legacy to stand up for the Union, that Virginia should be the mediator in the sectional conflict, the middle ground to resolve the differences between the extremists in Massachusetts and the extremists in South Carolina. And she was very, very disappointed when the secessionists cast off that mantle of mediator and sided with the extremists. That's how Van Loo saw all of this. So she remains committed to the Union and believes that that's what any true Virginian should do. Rather than fleeing Confederate Richmond once the shooting starts and going north, she chooses to stay at home on Church Hill and to help the Union cause as a spy. And she becomes the head of an elaborate espionage network called the Richmond Underground. This Richmond Underground affects the escape of Union prisoners of war from Confederate prisons. It passes vital tactical and strategic details about Confederate troop movements on to General U.S. Grant in the last year of the war as he lays siege to Richmond and Petersburg. Integral to this network are African-American unionists, such as a Van Loo servant named Mary Jane Richards. Van Loo secured for Richards a post as a domestic servant in the Confederate White House, and remarkable. And Richards was able to funnel what she learned in her intelligence gathering onto the couriers and agents of Van Loo. Two episodes, accomplishments, achievements of this Richmond Underground, which I'll highlight. In March of 1864, the Richmond Underground orchestrates the escape of 109 Union officers from Libby Prison. Libby Prison, the prison in Richmond where officers were held. And they do this, this is all primitive spy tradecraft, if you will. These men tunnel their way out of the prison. There's some Pennsylvania coal miners among those men imprisoned. They dig a tunnel and there's a Van Loo's people are waiting just outside the prison gates for the men as they emerge out of the tunnel to spirit them to the north and to freedom. Remarkable achievement. Second, and somewhat bizarre achievement that tells you a lot about the 19th century and the values of people at the time. And in order to describe this episode, I have to sort of give you a little context. So in 1864, the Union sends a man named Ulrich Dahlgren to essay a raid on Richmond, in which he's supposed to free some of the prisoners languishing in Confederate prisons, and possibly free enough of them to mount a sort of attack on the Confederate capital. So this man, Ulrich Dahlgren, is slain. The raid is a failure. The Confederates stop it in its tracks. And when Dahlgren is killed, papers are found on his body. And there's some controversy about whether they're authentic or not, but that's not all that important to my piece of the story here. Papers are found on his body in which he seems to have orders to assassinate Jefferson Davis. Papers that suggest that his mission was to assassinate Jefferson Davis. So the Confederates who find these papers are appalled. They say this is beyond the pale of civilized warfare, assassination. They're enraged. They mutilate Dahlgren's body and they bury it in an unmarked grave. They give it a dog's burial. So Van Loo and her Unionist people hear about this and they decide they are going to find Dahlgren's body. They're going to dig it up and they're going to bring it to the farm of a Virginia Unionist and give it a proper burial. Now, this meant a lot to them because in the 19th century, people had this very strong notion of a good death. A good death was one in which you're surrounded by family and friends who can testify to your readiness to meet your maker and who can form a sort of community of support around you. These people were determined to serve as Dahlgren's surrogate family, to give him that good death. So, remarkably, they find out through various agents where the body's buried. They dig up the body. They put it in the back of a cart, cover it with peach trees, go through the Confederate pickets, go to the farm of this Unionist and rebury it with this a little group of Unionists gathered around to give this young man a proper send-off. So that's all strange enough already, but here's an even stranger turn. The man's father was a prominent admiral in the Union, Admiral Dahlgren, and he implored the Confederate officials to send the body of his son back to him. He said, you know, whatever you may think of him, it's my boy, I want my boy's body back. And the Confederates say, no, we're not going to do it, but he doesn't let up. And eventually they say, yes, we'll send your boy's body back. And they go to retrieve the body from where they buried it, and it's gone. It's gone. And it's profoundly unnerving for the Confederates because they know there's this Unionist operation in the city, but they can't seem to catch anyone involved with it. And they call these two incidents I've described, the Libby outbreak and the Dahlgren exhumation, the Great Escape and the Great Resurrection. and together they really, again, are sort of deeply unnerving for the Confederates. This goes to, in some sense, the impact of the Union Underground. The Union Underground is helping to sustain Grant's morale in that final year of the war. Grant is fighting Lee on two fronts in the Richmond-Petersburg Theater and then in the Valley in the West. Lee has very few chess pieces left. He's moving them back and forth between the two fronts. Van Loo is able to tell Grant about the movements of Lee's troops back and forth between the two fronts. Again, the spy trade craft is very simple. Van Loo has guys standing at the train station, and when they see a bunch of Confederates getting on trains that are headed west, she's able to send her couriers to Grant. These couriers have eggs that are emptied out that have notes in them. They have hollowed out heels of their shoes in which they've put notes. These couriers, African American and white Unionists. And Van Loo is in almost daily contact with Grant in the last year of the war. His headquarters at City Point on the James River and Van Loo in Richmond. And she has people going back and forth to provide him with this information. So some of that is what you might call tactical or strategic information, but Grant is just as eager for information about the atmosphere in the city of Richmond. Grant is trying to keep up this war of attrition, wear down the Confederates, but the constant fighting in this last year of the war, beginning with the Overland Campaign. Grant, as you know, under a lot of pressure in the North. How is this man spending so many Union lives without success? Grant is saying, it's going to work. And Van Loo is able to send him messages from inside the Confederate capital speaking about the demoralization, the despondency, the suffering, giving a view of Richmond as a place that's really teetering on the brink of collapse. She says to him, their old men and boys are being herded into the army. Richmonders are despondent about the fall of Atlanta, about Lincoln's reelection, and so on. Grant gets a sense that this strategy of attrition is working. It's having its impact on Southern morale. So again, all of this begs yet another question, and that is, why was Van Loo not caught? So Van Loo had a few things going for her. One of them was that her elderly mother, Eliza, was widely regarded in the community as a paragon of Southern womanhood, the ideal Southern lady, pious, genteel, lovely, gracious, mannered. People loved Eliza. And Van Loo capitalized on this good family reputation by pretending that her own ministrations to Union prisoners were acts of Christian charity to the unworthy. So when the Confederates said, "Why are you coming here to bring custard or a book to this Union prisoner?" she would say, "Well, of course they're terrible, but a good Christian should hope for the redemption even of these desperate fellows," you know? So she pretended to be a loyal Confederate, in other words. Second advantage she had was that her family, her father had been a successful merchant, and they were pretty well set up, so she tapped her family's money to bribe Confederate officials. She bribed prison guards, she bribed clerks, she bribed people up and down the chain of command. And the sort of sad part of this is she emptied the family coffers to do so, so she's not... Her wealth is eroded during the war as she pulls on family funds for bribery. But more than anything, Van Loo is protected by the sexism of the Confederate establishment in Richmond. What do I mean? Well, once in 1864, acting on a tip from Van Loo's neighbors, the Confederate authorities decide to investigate Van Loo. Again, Van Loo living on Church Hill with her mother, Eliza. They want to ascertain if she's involved in disloyal activity. So they round people up. They interview neighbors. They interview some family members. They find a hostile witness, hostile to Van Loo, that is, in the form of her sister-in-law, Mary Van Loo, who loathes Elizabeth Van Loo. And Mary Van Loo is all too happy to say, yes, this woman is disloyal and up to no good. So this was one of these great aha moments we have as researchers. I was looking through records in the National Archives where the official records of the Union and Confederate governments are kept. And I was reading through this, and I finally got to the document that told me what Confederate officials decided after they'd gathered this information. And what they decided, and I'm paraphrasing them here, is that Van Loo was just a woman who liked to talk. They said, yes, she's likes to engage in some disloyal chatter, but she's just an old woman and couldn't possibly, and these are their words, have done anything to infirm the cause. Now, at that point, she had helped 109 people escape from Libby prison. She was in daily contact with Grant. She had, disinterred and reburied Colonel Ulrich Dahlgren. But, as far as they were concerned, here was Van Loo, a spinster, unmarried woman in her mid-40s, an old spinster, and she could not possibly have done anything to infirm the cause. So she got lucky. They reckoned her unionism was all talk, no action, and that she was incapable of having done them any harm. So after the war, Van Loo's spy activities come to light. And they come to light fully only in 1869, when President U.S. Grant, the successor to Andrew Johnson, President U.S. Grant, and one of the first things he does as president, he makes Elizabeth Van Loo postmaster of Richmond, Virginia. Yeah. This is a very smart audience. You're laughing at all the right places. So now we think of a job in the post office as a bureaucratic, not a political job. But back in the 19th century, the post office is the largest federal bureaucracy. So post office jobs are patronage plums. When a president and a new party comes into power, all the postmasters of the outgoing president of the other party are fired. And the partisan loyal, faithful, are rewarded with these jobs. It was widely understood that a postmastership was a stepping stone to political office. Benjamin Franklin had been a postmaster. Abraham Lincoln had been a postmaster. So here's old Van Loo. The women can't vote and won't be able to for many decades still. She's given this plum patronage job, pays well too. So what does she do as postmaster? Well, she's technically a very good postmaster. She modernizes the Richmond mail system. Everyone has to agree that the mails are running much better than they did before she came into office. But she also does something that doesn't endear her to her native Richmonders, at least to the white ones. She speaks out on behalf of women's suffrage. She hires African Americans and women to work in the Richmond post office. She publicizes to Northerners the proscription of African Americans in post-war Richmond, the violence and efforts to sort of prevent them from seizing the promise of freedom in the post-war South. And, what is the result? Van Loo is, after 8 years as embattled years as postmaster, is drummed out of office. And she's drummed out of office by two sets of opponents. One are ex-Confederates who really have loathed since day one, the idea that a Yankee spy is postmaster of Richmond, but she's also drummed out of office by men in her own party, the Republican Party, who are thinking, what's a woman doing in that plum job? A man should be in that job. She can't possibly be effective in that job. And she's drummed out of office under charges that she is, and this was not terribly original, but this is what they went for, that she was crazy, that she was hysterical, that she was unstable, that she didn't have the mental moorings in order to do this job properly. And we can date till this political smear campaign an image of Van Liu as crazy Bette. This kind of clung to her, and it became a story that Van Liu had evaded detection during the war by pretending to be crazy, and that that act had come easily to her because she was in fact crazy. So for years and years and years, those people who knew anything about Van Liu remembered her as crazy Bette. And as I was doing my research, I couldn't find any documents from the warriors themselves that suggested that she pretended to be crazy or was viewed as crazy. And the story never made much sense to me. Why would all those people put their lives in her hands and trust her? Not only union officials, but other unionists in Richmond, if she was thought to be unstable, never made any sense to me. So I discovered, really, that that's an image of her that emerges in the post-war period as part of this smear campaign, Crazy Bette. And the smear campaign served a purpose, in a sense, because the part of the reason that we don't know as much about Southern Unionism as we might is that in the post-war decades, as a kind of lost cause mythology glorifying the Confederate war effort took shape at the hands of both Northerners and Southerners, this became a story about Southern solidarity, about the way that the Confederacy had commanded the loyalty of all good Southerners, and the stories of Unionism got sort of swept under the rug. And it was indeed easier for Confederate Richmonders to think of Van Liu as Crazy Bette, as this kind of lone wolf, than to realize that she was the kind of razor-sharp spymaster of this group of indigenous dissenters. And indeed, I would argue that she represents, among many things, an indigenous reform tradition in the South. It's a group of people who have dissented from what the dominant political powers that be defined as the political orthodoxy at any given time. Van Liu's life, I'll sort of close with just a couple more observations. Van Liu's life sheds light on a foundational debate in the history of women and Southern women's history in particular, and it's a debate about among historians about whether the Civil War was a watershed or turning point for women. Some people argued, as this scholarship on women in the Civil War began, that it was a turning point in the sense that women did all these different sorts of things during the war. They took on all these new roles, and they translated all of this work outside of the old private or domestic sphere in the public world. They translated it into more public prominence, into a demand for their rights, and so on. And then that theory was countered by other scholars who said, that's a nice and comforting story, but the evidence suggests otherwise, that after the war, most Confederate women, for example, really wanted more than anything else a return to the way things had been before, that there was a real yearning to go back to the old ways. So we see mixed evidence on that question. I would argue that Van Liu's post-war life suggests that the war, in a sense, was a turning point for women, but not in the simple sense that it was good for women or advanced the quest for their rights. What the war did was lend credence to a doctrine of female accountability. This is a notion that women are not just innocents in wartime, people who are on the sidelines, but that they're agents who could be rewarded or punished for their political acts. So Van Liu advances this idea of accountability. The theme of Van Liu's embattled postmastership is accountability. She was rewarded by grant for her services to the state. And ex-Confederates, although they'd been blind to her political agency during the war because she kept them off the scent with her bribery and her pretending to be a Confederate lady and their sexism and all the rest, ex-Confederates held her accountable after the war for her wartime sins, right? It was unacceptable to them that a woman be in this position of prominence and openly advocating political views that they considered anathema. They refused to accept her attempts to cast herself as a nonpartisan civil servant and cast her as a traitor, whose punishment for her disloyalty should be a lifetime of derision and ostracism. And indeed, one of the sad ironies here about this Crazy Bette myth is that in the last years of her life, Elizabeth lived in poverty with her mother on Church Hill. The mansion had fallen into disrepair. She no longer had an income once she was drummed out of her postmastership. She had received threats from white supremacist groups, and when she went out in public, she was skittish. I mean, she felt scared. So people looked at this woman dressed in her 19th century garb, She looked to them like a paranoid and unstable woman, and you know, her fears were rooted in something real, but this just had the effect of sort of augmenting this image of her as crazy bed. Even after she dies, there will be sort of rumors that school children will be told, you know, Crazy Bet will get you if you don't do your homework, or Bet is still haunting that block of Church Hill. She took on this kind of ghostly image of a haunt, if you will. Interestingly, at the very same time that these stories of Crazy Van Loo were starting to circulate at the end of the 19th century, Elizabeth's oldest friend, a fellow unionist and longtime neighbor and co-worker in the post office, a woman named Eliza Griffin Carrington Noland, was trying in vain to publish an account of Elizabeth's life. Eliza began her manuscript, "In a few brief pages, I propose to portray the patriotic and philanthropic characteristics of Elizabeth Van Loo." This book was rejected by a Boston publisher. Carrington went on to say of Van Loo, "Possessed of a logical mind, Van Loo believed slavery to be a blot on the nation. When Patrick Henry stood in historic Old St. John's Church and shouted, 'Give me liberty or give me death,' this church was next to the Van Loo mansion, the walls of the old Van Loo mansion echoed, and Elizabeth Van Loo's heart caught up the refrain and cried, 'Give them, slaves, liberty or give me death.' Love for her family sustained her through her trials in life. I have never known as noble a woman." This is what Van Loo's dear friend says. We owe it to Van Loo to put the myth of Crazy Bet in its proper place and context, and to recover a sense of the real Elizabeth Van Loo, a woman whom we should remember not only for her intelligence gathering, but for her intelligence, and not only for her ability to conceal the truth, but for her ability to tell it. Thank you.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.